Hey everyone, it's your two favorite horror podcasters, professors, and nerds.
We're so excited to tell you about a new series from Horror Joy called Meet Your Maker.
This is a series dedicated to horror creators, their words, and their worlds.
We'll be sitting down for 30-minute interviews with some of horror's best-known authors, and some of the best authors you don't know, like Clay McLeod Chapman,
Victoria Dalpy,
Kat Silva,
John Langan,
Sadie Hartman, Mother Horror,
Emily Hughes,
Thomas Ha,
Matthew Trefon,
Jake Try,
and so many more. Whenever we do it, we can both try to do so many more at the same time.
And so many more. No. I don't think that's working.
Our goal is always to find joy in horror, and this gives us the opportunity to introduce you to new authors and creators and to discuss new books, stories, and movies with your old favorites.
This also means that we'll be dropping episodes every week.
So, get ready, yins, for more horror, more joy, more horror.
Horror joy! It's now been a year since we dropped our first episode of Horror Joy. We have done a lot of really cool things here. At least on our end, we are having an incredible time. And I think we are trying our best and succeeding in finding joy in horror. For me, the thing that I've enjoyed the most is getting to talk to people about horror, being able to discuss our favorite things about the genre that are sometimes heady and sometimes headless. And it's really exciting. It's always fun to talk to people like S. Trimble from the University of Toronto, like Stephen Graham Jones, who's written so much stuff and is so incredibly insightful. But every time that we get together, I'll just say that the thing that reminds me of the joy of horror are these conversations. And that will continue to be the greatest joy that I get out of Horror Joy. I have loved talking about Jaws. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And getting to know Jeff through horror rather than our stuffy academic jobs.
It's hard to believe it's been 1 year already, Yins. We have talked to authors, creators, about movies that both of us love. I'll mention The Blair Witch Project. I'll mention Silence of the Lambs. I really enjoyed our conversation with Brianna Cox on The Reformatory and Coogler's Sinners. I do think back to Jaws fondly and how that was where this journey began. And there really isn't anything gayer than three men on a boat. The community has been wonderful embracing this podcast. Paul Tremblay, Eric LaRocca. I think that the conversation we have for you all today, listeners, is another signpost in the road for Horror Joy. We spent the next 40 minutes or so in a conversation with Kevin Wetmore Jr., a professor at Loyola Marymount University. He's an educator. He is an author. He is an actor. He is a comedian. Kevin Wetmore Jr. has a lot to say about horror and joy, and we felt that this interview today was kind of a nice bow on the first year that is the gift of Horror Joy for me, for Brian, and we appreciate all of you who listen. We're going to turn it over to our conversation with Kevin.
This is Horror Joy. We're your hosts. I'm Brian Onishi.
And I'm Jeff Stoyanoff. We're two professors celebrating the emotional and intellectual joys of horror. All right, Yins, welcome back to Horror Joy. Today on Horror Joy, we are joined by Professor Kevin Wetmore, who is a theater professor at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. He is a writer. He is an actor. He is a comedian. He is a fight choreographer, among other things. And he just recently emceed StokerCon, so perhaps we'll get into that too. But Kevin, thank you for joining us today. And we're going to start with our usual question, which is, how do you see the relationship between joy and horror?
Oh, how long do we have? That's an awesome question. Well, one, I mean, the simplest answer is horror brings me joy. You know, if I'm looking for a relaxing evening, my wife and I will sit down and watch a horror movie we haven't seen or one that we really love. I'm teaching a horror cinema class right now at LMU, and I was explaining to students that for a horror fan, something like The Exorcist can be comfort viewing. You know, when I'm sort of the world has gone crazy, I'm going to sit down and it's like an old familiar blanket that just brings me happiness. So the horror is also a celebration of human resilience. As Jonathan Mayberry says, you can't have monsters without monster hunters. And though, you know, no one would buy a book called Jonathan Harker Doesn't Do Anything, you know, you need Dracula in there. The fun of it comes from sort of watching the good guys fight and sometimes defeat and sometimes not defeat the monster. And last but not least, as I mentioned, I'm teaching a horror cinema class right now. And just in yesterday's class, we watched The Bride of Frankenstein. And a student said, horror is a cure for boredom, because I'm never bored when I'm watching horror. You know, sometimes I'm flipping through things on different streaming services. But if I put a horror movie on, I'll sit and watch it and I'm not bored because I'm intrigued by what's going on. And more than most genres, and here, let's go for a deep cut. Noel Carroll says, it isn't really about the emotions even, it's about the cognitive stuff. We sit there, we watch, and horror makes you feel smarter because you figured out what's going on before everyone else. So there's sort of the rewards of horror can also make it a very joyful thing. You feel smart. Just thinking back to my own teenage years during the advent of VCRs, during the John Adams administration, my friends and I would sit around renting movies from the local video store. And inevitably at the end, the conversation would be what we would do in those circumstances. Here's the thing, man. If there were zombies coming through the streets of Cheshire, first of all, you get a sword. You know that. You know that. Second of all, and we would plan out, well, you never go there. I'd go to the high school. What? Yeah, think about it, man. And we'd have discussions about what we would do. And we didn't realize at the time we were preparing for natural disasters. We were preparing for what you would do when bad things happen. That's another gift of horror. And the thought of that gives me joy. So thinking about horror makes me happy. And a really good horror novel, I mean, again, the problem with being a horror fan, particularly a lifelong horror fan who lives in this stuff, is that like any addict, you need a bigger and bigger hit to get high. And so for me, there's a great joy when I pick up a novel or watch a movie or see a play. And I'm like, oh, I'm feeling that fear again. This is wonderful. Clive Barker says there is no delight the equal of dread. And I think he's right. Horror is about not what is happening, but the fear of what's about to happen. Guillermo del Toro says horror is a roller coaster for the soul. And I think that's a wonderful way to think about it. Because for me, roller coasters are, let's stand in line for an hour and a half for senseless velocity in a circle. Whee! And done. And in that same amount of time, I can sit through something as silly as Witchboard or something as intense as Talk to Me and be like, oh, yeah, that was okay. Give me 10 hours and Mike Flanagan will give you an entire, you know, arc of jump scares and dread. And here's the spooky stuff coming. So it is a good time to be a horror fan, but there's never been a bad time to be a horror fan. Just times where the horror isn't the best.
That's a lot of amazing stuff that you just dropped on us. So let's try to absorb some of this. I love what you're saying here. One of the things that I think I have been recently thinking about is the idea that joy is something that gets us outside of ourselves. And because of that, it feels communal in a way, right? A lot of times pleasure can be very individual. Joy, on the other hand, is something that seems in part communal. We do it together. Coming off of StokerCon as the MC, being in the horror world, like you said, with your friends, like you, I love this, like you feel smart because you know, don't go up the stairs, you know, all the silly rules of what you should and should not do in horror films. And you can point all these out as a horror film lover and a horror lover in general. I want to know what you think about this sense of community and the way that joy works in horror and community specifically.
Well, I have sort of two separate responses, one scholarly and one more personal. As a theater guy, as a comedian, as the MC of the Bram Stoker Awards, I'm always thinking about that weird process by which an I becomes part of a we. That all these people come together at 8 p.m. in the theater, that all these people come together. And it's, what is that thing that takes all these individuals and makes them into this entity of the audience? And I like to think about, you know, you go to a concert and there are a bunch of people there who perhaps if you encountered them outside the concert wouldn't even register, or, you know, you would wish slow death upon because of how they're driving or the way they're talking too loudly. You just, people are annoying. But you come together because of your shared love of they might be Giants or Slayer or Katy Perry or what have you. And you become this sort of community. You know, it's that idea of communitas, that when we come together as a group to share in an experience, that bonds us in a way. We maintain our individuality, but we have this wonderful group identity, this mathexis, this group sharing. And that's part of, I think, the joy of horror is that sense of we're going through it together. And at the same time, you notice things are scarier when you watch them with other people. When you watch them alone, you can unnerve yourself, but it's scarier with other people. And that's because we feed off of each other's fears. And that's because of this idea of mathexis, this idea of group sharing, that we're going through the experience together. The problem with that is that it can also be shifted. I went to see Paranormal Activity when that came out. My wife and I went to see it, and you know, it's the greatest movie ever made about a door opening slowly. And the audience, we were all jumping, and I don't do jump scares, you know, because intellectual watching a horror movie, I'm like, oh yes, that's very scary. And my wife's like, no, if it were scary, you'd be afraid. You're intellectualizing it. But I was feeling the friction of fear, and it was wonderful, except there was one gentleman there who was under some kind of chemical influence. So every time you saw the time and date stamp on the bottom of the screen, he would start going, oh, Jesus, God, baby, Jesus, no. And the whole audience then turned because we began laughing. Every time this guy was freaking out, we began laughing, and Paranormal Activity became a horror comedy for us. But we didn't mind because it was, again, a fun group experience. We all sort of walked out of there going, like, you know, watching a good horror movie together, everyone's a Vietnam veteran. You walked out and you're like, I was there, Third Street Promenade, midnight. I saw that go down, man. Like, there's that wonderful bonding experience. So as a person who tries to create that for my audiences, whether as a director, an actor, a comedian, et cetera, as someone who studies it, as a scholar, looking at what takes all these people who have just come from all these different places, we're just sitting in seats in the same room, and we are now one. It's almost a religious thing. The pushback, however, is I think there is also a great deal of individual joy. There's the thing that is yours, and certainly horror hipsters, there's that notion of, well, nobody else knows about this, or I was the first one to see Skinamarink. Okay, but for me, there's an even greater joy, which is the guilty pleasure. One of my favorite films is a film called Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. Do not watch it. It is horrible. It was made by a group of college graduates in Miami in 1971 by Bob Clark, the same guy who went on eventually to make Black Christmas and A Christmas Story, of all things. But this is his first or second film, and it's ugly. It's you know, it's a first effort. But there are so many wonderful moments in it. It's about a group of actors who take a boat to an island off the coast of Miami to rehearse a play and accidentally awaken the dead. And they're chewing the scenery like the Cookie Monster. But I saw it when I was 12. And to my 12-year-old sense of taste, which probably has not improved that much, it was perfection. And so anytime I'm feeling super low or I just want to be in my happy place, I'll throw on Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. And it brings me joy. No audience in the world would do that with me. I've seen it on the big screen with other people. It's the beautiful thing about living in Los Angeles is we have a lot of art houses here that'll be like, hey, we're going to show these sort of more obscure horror films. I was fortunate enough to see The Thing on my birthday, another favorite movie, several times because the New Beverly seems to think early February is thing time. So, you know, there's joy to be found in the guilty pleasure, and there's joy to be found in the collective joy of we're all in it together, and we all just we're laughing at ourselves because we jumped at that, or laughing at the guy who's going through a traumatic experience at this movie because of whatever he ingested. Either way, we're going through it together, and so these are my brothers and sisters. We few, we happy few. We who sat through an early screening of Smile.
Yeah, I really love like where you're taking this, Kevin. I think it's interesting to think about how the joy of horror can be amplified by like being in an audience of people, but also there are ways in which it is kind of reflected within oneself and amplified just sometimes on your own, like watching, you know, my guilty pleasure horror movie is probably The Blair Witch Project. I could watch that movie once a day for the rest of my life and I would still like it because it's creepy. It's my favorite found footage film. I mean, I think it's like one of the first found footage films. So I'm hearing all of that. Now, when you were talking about sort of community and how there's almost like a ripple effect sometimes with horror in this way. And you also said the word boat, which got me to thinking about the movie Jaws, which is where for us here at Horror Joy, it's where it all began. And it is Shark Week is coming up. It's that time of the summer, right? So, and Jaws just turned 50. So there's a lot of things going on with Jaws, but so many of these films, and maybe this will pique your cinema scholar interest as well, that I would qualify or classify as horror films were never considered horror films. You know, they were not in that section of the video store. They would not be marketed that way. So one of the things we've been trying to do on the podcast is try to grapple with this question of why horror is considered a lesser genre. Like, why is horror less than, say, drama or, you know, serious movies? So you know, if you want to talk about Jaws in this way, great. If you just want to like go on thinking about why do we think is horror, or why do others, we clearly don't, why do others think of horror as less than?
Okay, set the clock for 45 minutes. Here we go. There's a lot to answer there. So, let's first talk about Jaws. Jaws is the original summer blockbuster. It's Spielberg at his finest. He's sort of developing his milieu, which consists primarily of reaction shots before action shots, which I thought is absolutely brilliant. If you look at Jurassic Park, Close Encounters, Jaws, you see people's reactions before you see the thing that they're reacting to, because that primes you. So Jaws, I think, has survived the test of time in terms of it nails all of the elements, because it's not a story about a giant shark. It's a story about how people respond to a giant shark in the waters off their home. And so we go through with Chief Brody, who's not from Amity. You're not from around here. Hiya, Chief. You know, there's this whole fun sort of vibe of, we're getting to know the island the same as him. And Spielberg, again, has a lovely sense of humor. You have, you know, the scenes where Lorraine Gray's character, the chief's wife, has grown up on the island. The water doesn't frighten her. But then she sees a painting of a shark attacking him. Michael, did you hear your father? Get out of the boat. And everyone in the audience laughs because we understand that very human moment. I'm going to say something slightly blasphemous here, but Spielberg, like Shakespeare, and I'm a big Shakespeare guy, reminds us of what it is to be human. The strongest moments in Spielberg aren't CG dinosaurs or a big scary mechanical shark. They're the moments that remind us, yeah, that feels right. That feels like what people would actually do in that situation. The funny thing for me about Jaws is it's a horror film for the first two thirds, and then it becomes an action adventure movie. You know, how are we going to kill this shark? Because once you reveal the monster, and Lovecraft is a racist, but I'm going to agree with him on this one, the oldest and strongest emotion of humanity is fear. The oldest and strongest fear is fear of the unknown. When you can't see that thing, you just know it's there. I mean, you know it's a shark. It's a movie called Jaws. They've advertised it. No one walks into Jaws going, the hell is this about? Oh, it's a shark. Okay. Didn't see that coming. You know, you're expecting a shark. You're needing a shark. But he holds that shark from you for the longest time. And for my money, the scariest moment in that film is not in those action-adventure scenes later. You're going to need a bigger boat or even the monster chomping down on Quint, because that's all expected. It's when the shark is in the pond and the guy in the rowboat gets tipped over and you see the sort of blurry version of the shark coming up to take him. And it's just a reminder, this is what's lurking under the water always. And for me, that shot has always been good old-fashioned nightmare fuel. I see it and I'm like, we're going to watch something else before bed because I need to cleanse this palate. So Jaws is effective in that it's not just trying to scare you. It's trying to create a perfectly believable situation. There's not a false note in it. And far too often, filmmakers are not trying to necessarily, you know, make a human story. They're trying to scare you, or they're following the tropes of the genre. You know, I like to point out to people, do you know how many people die in the original Halloween? 5. That's it. And after the pre-credit kill of Michael Myers' sister Judith, you're going to wait another 45 minutes before anyone else goes. And the problem is Hollywood's sequels came along and said, oh, we need a death at least every 6 to 8 minutes to keep the audience entertained. And that's not horror. That's just, you know, a scorecard. And there, you're not there to be scared. You're there to see the unique and interesting ways in which Michael or Jason or Freddy or Chucky or the alien or the predator kills people. The mystery is gone, so it's just about body count, and it's just about enjoying the pleasure of watching people die in interesting ways. And they're not even that interesting. So that's why when something comes along, like Talk to Me or Bring Her Back or Paranormal Activity, that's new and different, not just fans, but everyone's like, this is good. I refer to horror people as the Halloween people, because we're people. Halloween is not a holiday. It's a lifestyle and a mindset. Horror people are just fortunate enough to have it in their heart and head all year round, because it's the funnest holiday. And it's also, to bring it full circle back to audiences, it's the only civic holiday. When you think about it, most of the major holidays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, or New Year's Eve, are about being with family and friends. And you stay within your domicile, or you go to a restaurant and you're like, here and no one else, just us, this inner group. Halloween is when you invite complete strangers to come to your door and ask for food. Halloween is when you go to the doors in your neighborhood when you're a little kid and get a little older, the next neighborhood over, and maybe we're even going to go down to Brentwood and trick-or-treat there because they get full bars. And it's that notion of you're going to the community. You're seeing inside people's houses. They're offering you food. You're exchanging. Oh, isn't that a great costume? Even more than the 4th of July, where we all might gather together, but again, we're all looking up to the sky flowers. Because here in America, we celebrate our birth with blowing things up and eating outdoor meat. The idea of Halloween is we're a group. We're a community. Let's celebrate scary things together. Except for the people who give out Jesus pencils or toothbrushes. Shame on you. You're ruining it for the rest of us. In terms of the idea of horror, this is why I loathe the term elevated horror. Because it implies that, well, there's elevated horror and then there's horror, which, as we all know, is the unhoused person in cinema. We don't want it here. It's over there. Some people might enjoy talking to it, but good Lord, it smells, it's strange, and it makes me nervous, and I don't want to see it, thank you. And when you talk to people, because I'll go to things like the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books and be at the Horror Writers Association booth, people come up and say, I don't like horror. I'm like, okay, what don't you like about horror? Well, the killing. I'm like, okay. There's no killing in something like the Haunting of Hill House. I mean, there's some deaths at the end, but it's not, you know, a psycho killer. And well, I don't like this. And you begin to realize when they say horror, what they really mean are slasher films. And you start asking them about the more elevated stuff. And they're like, oh, yeah, I did see that. And I'm like, Midsommar's not elevated. It's just as bloody and nutty as anything Wes Craven ever put out. It's just, you know, Ari Aster gets a pass because somehow it's smarter. Except, is it? And again, I don't mean to denigrate Ari Aster here, who does amazing work. But there are other people out there who are doing really interesting things, really smart things. Just last night, again, for horror and joy, I rewatched The Blackening because I need to remind myself every once in a while, what a smart and funny and socially incisive film that is. And it shows sort of the best of what horror can do, where you're sort of surprised by the thoughts that you're having because it's a horror movie and it's funny. And these characters are sometimes playing stereotypes, sometimes playing real people. But then one of them will say something and I go, oh, my God, I never thought of it that way. That is amazing. No one would call The Blackening elevated horror, but it's brilliant horror. When I talk to students these days, what's your favorite horror film? They're like Barbarian or The Conjuring. And I think, oh, now why is that? Why is that your favorite? What is that? What is the appeal of that for you? You know, tell me your favorite horror film and I can tell you a few things about yourself then, because that tells me what scares you. And as a scholar, what interests me is sociophobics. So far more than romance, far more than almost any other genre, horror is the genre that tells us what we collectively, as a society, as a culture, are afraid of. I've made the argument that horror writers knew that Trump was going to be elected in 2016. Why? Because you have films like Don't Breathe, 10 Cloverfield Lane, all these films about grumpy old white men in the bunker with a gun saying, you can get in the bunker, but I'm in charge. And it's this sort of backlash in the wake of President Obama of the angry old white men with guns ain't sitting for it anymore, and they're going to use the monsters as an excuse. And good Lord, didn't that play out. So I think horror tells us what we are collectively afraid of. In fact, I wrote a whole book about that, about how 9/11 profoundly changed horror. And you're right, Blair Witch isn't the first found footage film. To that, we might look at something like Cannibal Holocaust, where it's a found footage film within a film. And then there's a Belgian film called Man Bites Dog, which is a group following a serial killer. But Blair Witch sort of was the one that exploded. What is amazing to me is there was no explosion of found footage after Blair Witch. Everyone was like, that was lightning in a bottle, we're not even going to try. But then 3 years later, after 9/11, found footage explodes, not because of Blair Witch, but because of 9/11. The fact that we all went through a live horror movie, watching cameras shakily running through the street as things are happening, turning back, showing us the thing as it's happening. Then suddenly you have over 300 found footage films in the next 10 years. And that's because we experienced that horror. And so we tried to sublimate it into things like The Last Exorcism, Apollo 18. Let's see these found footage things that, you know, this is real. This is really happening. And that sort of makes it scarier and creepier. And again, that's how that superhero movies, Westerns and sci-fi were how we dealt with 9/11. Battlestar Galactica, Deadwood, all of the Avengers movies are America responding to 9/11 and the wars after. We sublimate our own fear and anger and guilt into genre cinema. And horror, obviously, since horror deals with fear and we were people very much afraid, I think one of the reasons why horror is enjoying another golden age is we are very much afraid again. There's so much to be afraid of, and COVID alone. You know, I was asked, are there going to be a lot of horror films about diseases now? Nah. We live through a disease. The horror films that you're going to see, and we're seeing it now, are being trapped alone in a cabin somewhere with someone, having to isolate with your family, or the horrors of social media. Even while COVID was going on, Host came out, and Host was brilliant. Predictable, but brilliant. So I think there's an animosity towards horror because it is perceived as low, because it's a visceral genre, in much the same way that comedy very rarely wins awards, because the whole point of horror, according to Aristotle, or the whole point of tragedy at least, is fear and pity. You're supposed to be afraid for and of, and you're supposed to feel sorry for people. And horror decides to go through that through monsters or gross out or the supernatural and serial killers. And that just feels sort of low, except then Silence of the Lambs wins all 5 major Oscars. Because when it is, I think the problem isn't the genre itself. The problem is so many people go, oh, we can make a horror movie and it will make money. And it will, because horror is the triumph of hope over experience. And this goes back to my days in the video store of, well, this box looks interesting and the title's cool. It won't be that bad. Well, you know, surely Urban Vampires 8 won't be as bad as Urban Vampires 7. They can't get any worse. No, no, they can. And so horror fans are willing to settle for the dumbest stuff. You know, if Lincoln had been a horror movie, they would have made Lincoln 2 with, like, Casper Van Dien as Lincoln, low-budget special effects, and it turns out that John Wilkes Booth was a zombie master from outer space with a guest appearance from Danny Trejo as, you know, as James Buchanan. You're like, what are you doing, movie? Like, well, people, it'll make money. And so it's rare when you get things like Night of the Living Dead, Carnival of Souls, that are low-budget movies made just to make money that are also still good movies in their own right.
Yeah, there's just like this interesting thing that you just said about, I think, the viscerality of horror and comedy. It feels like it's rooted somehow like rooted in the body, and we're back to Plato and like this distinction between what is good and what is not good, and the body ends up being degraded, right? And that goes through, you know, the Western Christian church at this idea that, okay, the horror is not mental, right? It's not reasonable. It's not rational, or maybe this is where elevated horror comes in. And like you're saying, it kind of ruins this reputation further of what horror as a genre is doing. I think that's really interesting. I want to shout out the New Beverly also. I grew up in Southern California. I saw Alien there for the very first time long after it came out, and used to go to the New Bev, loved it, saw a bunch of movies there. And so I appreciate that you brought that up. The one thing I wanted to kind of hit on is, so I was reading some of your book on horror post 9/11, really insightful. Folks, if you are looking for a book that does some good, insightful work on horror, I think this is a really interesting one. Something that I've kind of maybe two inroads here. One, we just talked about Final Destination, and Final Destination happens before 9/11. But it has centrally located as part of the terror or the plot device or whatever, an exploding plane, right? And so we kind of talked a little bit about that. Maybe you can fill in some of that there. But the other one is, like, you make this argument about slashers and gender, the kind of anxiety about gender changes from kind of what we first get with Halloween, Prom Night, right? All of these kind of early slashers of Friday the 13th and all those things, till later they become something different, and gender might help us to understand the difference.
Sure. Well, let's take the second one first. Carol Clover, of course, in Men, Women, and Chainsaws. And if you're going to read one horror book this lifetime, Men, Women, and Chainsaws is the one to read. It's so insightful. She coins the term final girl. God bless you, Carol. You're doing the work of the Lord. And her whole thing is that critics and people were misreading horror. They're like, oh, horror is misogynistic and hates women. And Clover looked at it and said, no, the final survivor is always female, and she's the one who keeps a bit of wits about them. The men in horror movies, and again, Clover is talking really about slasher films, are not that smart. They get drunk. They're constantly in pursuit of sex. And then, you know, every once in a while, one will be like, who's the guy in the hockey mask? And, you know, that is the fastest one to die. So horror films are about how we sort of deal with gender anxiety. But her point is, these are actually cautionary stories that show girls. You know, we forget that in the original Halloween, Jamie Lee Curtis isn't a goody-goody. She's attracted to Ben Tramer, doesn't necessarily want to go to homecoming because boys are still new, even though her friends are sort of, you know, freaks between the sheets. She's like, well, I'm just dipping my toe in the boy thing. But she smokes a joint with her friend in the car. She covers for her friends. She lies to people so their friends can go have sex with their boyfriends while she babysits. I mean, she's not a goody-goody. What she is someone who keeps her wits about her and pays attention so that when there are scary things happening, she's the one who goes, oh, there's a dude out there. Oh, something's going on. The whole point is the final girl stays alert and is active, not reactive. Hey, kids, run out the front door. I'm going to go upstairs and get a coat hanger and do something about this. The final girl is smart. She's not a goody-goody. You know, the conservative nature of slasher films, yeah. But it's not as conservative as you think, because it says, you know, a smart, empowered woman is the one who's going to save us all. That's a really progressive kind of message. What happens after 9/11 is the argument that I make in the book is 9/11 changes the demographic of who dies, because 9/11 said death. If you were on the 101st floor, you died. If you were on the 75th floor, you lived. It had nothing to do with who you were as a person. It had nothing to do with what you were doing. It had everything to do with where you were. To me, one of the most quintessential post 9/11 films is The Strangers. Why are you doing this? Because you were home. Had you not been home, we would have gone to another house and done it to them. So it's not you, it's where you are. And so with slasher films now, again, it's not the kids who are smoking, drinking, and partying. It's everybody. You're all going to die. death comes for us all. And I'm going to come back to that with the Final Destination thing. So in slasher films, we no longer have the final girl who is resourceful and smart. We have the final couple. That what survives at the end of the reboot of Halloween, the reboot of Friday the 13th, the 2009 one with Jared Padalecki, that it's always, you know, Cabin in the Woods, which is horror, but also slasher, and plays around with the idea of teenagers being killed in order. It's the two of them, Marty and the girl, survive to die. But the who is alive at the end of the film is a couple. Even if they're not a couple together couple, a man and a woman, heteronormative couple, have to survive. Because, you know, sort of that's what we see is people holding each other's hands running through the debris. And so we, you know, 9/11 sort of shifts it from the concerns about women in society to have to get through this and keep going. And we can only do that if we can reproduce. So the fear is changed in terms of the slasher film itself. That formula sticks around for about another 10 to 12 years after 9/11. We're now reverting back to Final Girl. And certainly there was an obsession about 5 years ago with Final Girls. We had a movie, The Final Girls, Final Girls, The Final Girl, a TV series, Final Girls. So this scholarly idea that this, you know, wonderful professor came up with is now this trope that is in all these horror movies. You're right. Final Destination was before 9/11, but it was already tapping into a lot of fear of flying because, of course, we had a whole series of air disasters in the 90s, Flight 420 in Pittsburgh. And there was the crash in Austin, going back even to the 80s, where the Soviets had shot down Flight 87 over the Koreas, I believe. So you had sort of an increase in air disasters in the 90s that were making people nervous. The 90s was also a weird decade because we no longer had the Soviet bad guys. And, you know, the worst thing that we could think about is the president was cheating on his wife in the Oval Office and then lied about it under oath. You know, the nation was in crisis. So there wasn't, you know, the 90s was a weird time for horror because we kind of banished the supernatural throughout that period. And so you get Scream, you get I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legend, Valentine's Day, Cry Wolf. It's all these human monsters, which made sense for the decade. And it ends, of course, with Blair Witch Project and the M. Night Shyamalan film, Sixth Sense. You know, we finally at the end, as we're getting closer to the millennia, the supernatural starts coming back. And in 1999, we get all these films in which celebrities fight the devil. Winona Ryder versus the devil, Arnold Schwarzenegger versus the devil, Kim Basinger versus the devil. In the case of Final Destination, it's funny, I wrote an essay on the Final Destination films for a book called Death, a Companion, in which I posit that the Final Destination movies are the ultimate slasher film because they do away with the middleman. Death itself is the serial killer. And death is going to kill, you know, and it follows Carol Clover exactly. You have the bad place where something happened. People escape death. And so death, which is now anthropomorphized, not in human form, but anthropomorphized in that it has a will, it has a plan. They talk about death as a being with efficacy and advocacy and agency. And you've upset death's plan. So now death is coming for you. Here's the thing. Death is coming for all of us anyway. All these people are dying while everyone else is dying. Big fat Harry. But now because you escaped death on the exploding plane, now you're going to slip on a roller skate, hit your head on a shower curtain. You're going to fall down, and instead, then all these things are going to fall on your head. And just when you think you've fallen, you've made it through, Skylab is going to crash on your house and kill you. You know, it's the almost die, almost die, almost die, die. And so, with each the higher number Final Destination, the more Rube Goldberg the deaths become. So it's the same thing that happens to every other slasher film, but because it's now death personified, it's really about death itself is out to get you. And here's where I'll give props to the producers, the makers, the marketers, what have you. I think Final Destination 2 is the one that made everyone go, oh my, I won't drive behind logging trucks anymore because of that movie. And in fact, I've seen logging trucks with no one behind them. And I think it's that film. So when it came to do Final Destination Bloodlines, they put banners on logging trucks advertising the film. Whoever came up with that campaign, you are a genius. You deserve every cent you got. That is wonderful. Final Destination 3, if memory serves, was a roller coaster, which is stupid, because the final destination of a roller coaster is your starting point. And that's what's telling you they're no longer even thinking about the title. They're just thinking about, this is a gruesome death vehicle delivery system. It's a NASCAR race. It's a bridge collapse. It's a, oh no, we're going to go back to a plane again. Oh, building collapse. We just need to find an event where a whole bunch of people die and then kill the escapees in interesting order. And that brings us back to the problem of horror, which is lather, rinse, repeat. Ad nauseum until you hit Jason in space.
You know, I forgot all about Jason in space until you just said it. And now I'm going to just like have to go back and revisit that for reasons,
it's
just for research.
Film. There are some beautiful moments in, oh, see, folks, he just wanted his machete back, is a brilliant line. When we program the holodeck to trick Jason, we just need nubile girls who want to have premarital sex. That'll fool him. I'm like, okay, you have a sense of, you know what you are and you're not trying to be better. I accept you.
Yeah. That's great. So one of the things when you brought up, I mean, we talked about Final Destination, the Rube Goldberg machine. I'm glad we're using that same language because we thought very much the same thing. One of the things that the first Final Destination, especially, and maybe the second a bit, we were talking about the slasher or death as the slasher, got me as a medievalist thinking about Memento Mori, you know, and the idea of the sort of image of death. So if we could take a quick, like, left turn, veer off the road here, one of your other books, The Eaters of the Dead, Myths and Realities of Cannibal Monsters, that's going to be coming out soon in paperback, I think you told me. You have an entire chapter on Grendel and the ogres. And I, you know, Brian at one point asked me, and I think we've had this conversation on the podcast before, about what medieval horror is there? And I was like stumped for a minute, because like other than hell and, you know, maybe some things in romances, we're not taught medieval literature as horror. But when I was reading your chapter on Grendel and the ogres, I was like, okay, well, yeah, obviously Beowulf's horror. Like that's what the entire, it's a ghost story. I mean, it's a monster story. These people are sitting around this mead hall talking to each other about. So maybe not speaking to Beowulf specifically, maybe you can, but one of the other elements of horror that I know you work with as a director, as an actor, is theater. And we haven't talked at all about horror in like the play, the form of a play. So, you know, if you obviously, you know, you talked about Shakespeare, so I could think of Macbeth. In The Eaters of the Dead, you talk about the Tempest a bit and Titus Andronicus with how we see cannibalism there. The way you're talking about viewing horror in a movie theater and the idea of the audience reaction and how that plays into your reaction, that to me as a drama person is very much how live theater works too, where like our presence in the theater, in the crowd, actually is influencing how we're interpreting what's going on around us too. So I'm just wondering if you could maybe just briefly talk about like horror and drama. I know that's a huge question, but yeah.
Grendel, horror, drama, Shakespeare, Memento Mori. All right, let's tie it all together in one big bow. And in fact, I'm even going to go back to an earlier question of yours of things that are horror, not horror, and horror sort of despised. John Skipp and Craig Spector, the splatterpunk authors who know quite a bit about horror themselves, they wrote wonderful novels back in the 80s and 90s, once wrote an essay with a title along the lines of, "Your favorite movie is a horror movie." And they talked about how Amadeus, the Academy Award-winning film based on the Peter Schaefer play, is a horror movie. It opens with a man trying to slit his own throat in an insane asylum, and then confesses to a priest about how he gaslit his rival by pretending to be his rival's dead father, his rival's dead father's ghost, demanding that he write a funeral mass for him, which eventually drove him into illness and death. And they're like, that is a horror movie. And here's where we get to sort of the ugliness and challenge of genre, because horror, I describe horror as the Los Angeles of genres. Los Angeles isn't a city like New York. It's a downtown with 87 separate, you know, neighborhoods. So they're all in horror, but they're very different from one another. So how do we define horror? Especially the boundaries are so porous. Alien is sci-fi, but it's horror. The Terminator is sci-fi, but it's horror. And I would argue that horror, we define horror as the genre that's supposed to create fear, except even that is problematic because most horror movies that we name didn't actually cause fear in me. Instead, it follows the tropes of horror. There's a werewolf in it, it's horror. I wasn't scared at all, but it was horror because it had a werewolf. So we define it as maybe the genre that has a monsters, but there's plenty of horror films that don't have monsters. So I like to think of horror as the genre in which we confront our own death. As Stephen King says, death is when the monsters get you. So we're confronting the reality of pain, suffering, and death, and it causes fear in us. Perhaps effectively, perhaps not, but we're dealing with that idea of the death of the ego, the death of the self, and something like The Taking of Deborah Logan. You know, it's not a serial killer film, but it's about the death of something inside and being replaced by something else. It's one of the most brilliant sort of artistic analyses of someone entering into dementia or Alzheimer's as a horror movie. So in terms of the medieval sense of it, yeah, Memento Mori, remember, you too will die. You owe God a death. We are the only creature aware of its own mortality. We are born astride a grave, as Beckett says. In fact, there's a wonderful book that I will also recommend to your viewers and listeners called The Worm at the Core, which if you have not read it, is this sort of psychological philosophical treatise about how the worm at the core of human experience is the knowledge that someday we will not be. And so all human culture, all human activity is designed to stop us from thinking about our own inevitable ends, that everything that we do is against death. And even the people who embrace death, you know, the goth kids, they're actually using their embrace of death to fight death. It's this assertion of, no, I am, I exist, I matter. So in terms of the theater, for me, the theater can be one of the most effective ways. We're a culture that has grown profoundly used to cinema, and cinema does special effects very well. And so theater can never outdo cinema in that sense. What theater can do is it's live and it deals with presence. When you are scared watching Cabin in the Woods, you are scared of colored lights on a wall with a soundtrack or digital pixels on a screen. When you go to see Play Dead or you go to see Sleep No More, suddenly, there's something strange happening and then eye contact with a real person and they're looking at you. And this, I think, part of the problem with Macbeth is it isn't scary to us because witches aren't scary. Jesuits aren't scary. The things the social things that cause fear in Macbeth don't cause us. And because many of us, if you go to see it in high school, inevitably the three witches are all, Stevie Nicks impersonators twirling around in black lace going, prophecy, prophecy, prophecy. Okay, cool. That's not scary. That's that girl from my English class. When you start thinking about Macbeth as horror, then you start going, okay, what is it in this text that is genuinely creepy, that is genuinely terrifying, that is uncanny? How can we defamiliarize this text because we're so used to it? And yeah, Titus Andronicus is over the top. No one, not even Sir Patrick Stewart, could pull off the line, there they are baked in that pie, when he finally reveals that Tamora has eaten her own sons. Which, that's, even in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that's, people laugh at that moment when they reveal, oh, they eat people. The only time I've ever seen cannibalism even slightly effective as a gross out is in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, where they reveal they've been eating meatloaf. And if you weren't expecting it, okay, that was kind of a startle. It's as much a jump scare as it is a sort of psychological dread. But we know they're eating. We're just waiting for the revelation. And the fun of it comes from a psychotic Titus going, there they are, baked in that pie. And the audience is like, ha, ha, that's awesome. We instantly all turn into 13-year-old boys. Where things get genuinely scary is, I think, when we are then forced to deal with that sense of dread of our own mortality, of the inescapability of pain, death, and suffering. Again, a quintessential post 9/11 horror film is The Mist. That ending is just a gut punch. And if you're not sitting there at the end, if you're able to walk out when the credits start, you don't have a soul, because that ending is just sort of a, yeah, he did that. And wow. Oh my God, I just sat there going, well done. Because Stephen King's original does not end that way. It ends with the primary character sort of, the story is his journal of what happened. And he's like, we're in a restaurant at a rest stop off of I-84. And there are two words that keep us going, hope and Hartford. We heard a broadcast with that word and so we're headed there. And it's like, okay, Maine is gone. New Hampshire and Massachusetts are gone, but Connecticut might still be there. So his short story ends in hope, and Frank Darabont's film version is, no, here are your guts, here's your heart, and here's your last abiding sense of hope. Now give in to hopeless, bleak despair, curse God, and die. And I'm sure the medievalists in the audience were like, well done, well done. What scares us in medieval drama? Well, medieval drama doesn't scare us in much the same way that it often doesn't move us, because it's the I'm going to use classical theory here, historicity versus transhistoricity. Hamlet still works. We still put on Hamlet because at the time, Hamlet was about royal succession, who becomes king after the current monarch dies because Liz is on the throne and she's dying. It's about who's right, Catholic versus Protestant. The ghost says that he's in purgatory during the day, but Protestants don't believe in purgatory. So what? And there are all these elements in Hamlet that are so much England 1600. I don't know about y'all, but I don't care about royal succession. Don't care about purgatory, whether you believe it or not. To quote Thomas Jefferson, neither picks my pocket nor break my leg. Believe in whatever you want. So Hamlet shouldn't function, and yet it still does. Why? Because it's also about all these other things. What happens after we die? The fear of death. Who can you trust? I can't trust anyone except my high school best friend. My high school girlfriend turns out to be a psycho who's abused. My college friends who have come to visit were specifically brought here by my stepdad to spy on me. And my girlfriend's brother is a little crazy with the sword. I can't trust mom, can't trust stepdad, who's also my uncle, and that's kind of weird. Yeah, I mean, all of that is very relatable. There's a reason why Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, Midsummer Night's Dream, everyone's like, yeah, Shakespeare's awesome. Really? When's the last time you saw Timon of Athens? When's the last time you saw Troilus and Cressida? When's the last time someone put on Henry VI Part II? They don't have the transhistoricity. They don't have the elements that are relevant to us. And that's the problem for medieval theater as well, is it becomes very hard to really. We were just at a medieval festival in Toronto, And the plays that resonated with the audience were either the ones that sort of had enforced meaning, where Herod Antipas is presented as Trump. Okay, we're not getting the medieval play. We're getting this sort of historical overlay that makes us go, okay, we understand this play better now. And we're laughing at it in ways that medieval people might not have. But, you know, once they're nailing in Jesus and talking about how hard it is to nail this guy to the cross, these are just working class medieval people, you know, who want to kick off and go get a beer after work. They're relatable, but the horror of crucifixion isn't there, you know. So the more horror, and even the devil is a clownish figure rather than a scary one. And I don't think the intention necessarily of medieval theater is to put fear in you other than fear of God. And the whole idea is to teach salvation theology, which is actually, pardon the pun in this podcast, a joyful thing. Hey, all of this stuff means that you're saved if you just do what the church tells you. From that, you go home and, you know, maybe you hear the story of Beowulf, which is about they're sitting around the mead hall in the dark in Scandinavia where the nights are long, and Grendel comes in and tears limbs and eats heads. Yeah, that's horrifying, until, you know, Beowulf comes along and does the damage and then goes after the mother. Beowulf invents a sequel. He fights Grendel, and then you have Beowulf 2, Grendel's mother. And then finally, Beowulf 3, the dragon, the original Beowulf trilogy.
There's a long pause between Beowulf 2 and Beowulf 3.
There is.
That's what every time I'm teaching that poem, my students are like, what? Why? Why do we have all this? I'm like, well, it's part of the genre. It's the epic. He's doing a lot of things. He's living his long life. And then we have, you know, the horror of old age in some ways for someone in a warrior culture like that. So,
well, the danger for Beowulf, of course, is that he dies not in battle. I mean, if you don't die in battle, right? Even though it's beginning to become a Christian text, it's a pagan text that is being converted to Christianity, so to speak. Man, you don't go to Valhalla if you don't die in battle. Dying of old age is kind of shameful. So go fight that dragon,
exactly.
Get honor and glory one last time, and then give it over to Wiglaf. It'll be fine.
Yep. All right. So, Kevin, we can't thank you enough for taking the time today. We are going to start wrapping up. Usually what we ask at the end here is just if you could recommend maybe one or two things currently. I mean, you've just given us a boatload of things in horror that bring you joy. But maybe something currently that you're reading or something you've just watched that you found exceptionally joyful.
Oh, God. Well, as I mentioned, I just rewatched The Blackening, which was tremendously fun. Bringing Her Back did not bring me joy, but I found it wonderfully fascinating. And that's one of those films that you just keep going, no, no, no. I'm doing, for another scholarly project, I'm doing a rewatch of all of Mike Flanagan's Netflix series. And of course, first and foremost in my heart is The Haunting of Hill House. But I have a deep and abiding joy for The Mask of the, or not The Mask of the Red Death, what do you call this Poe thing? Fall of the House of Usher, which is just a lot of fun in terms of Easter eggs and playing around with genre and his own canon. In terms of reading, I'm constantly reading stuff. I just went through a space horror phase, so S.A. Barnes' horror novels set in space have been a lot of fun. In terms of actual just genuine joy, I've been finding a lot in the theater. Qui Nguyen, who's a Vietnamese American playwright, writes sort of very doofy, goofy genre plays that are a lot of fun. And I've been reading a lot. Oh, Nat Cassidy's When the Wolf Comes Home is what I'm reading right now, about an actress waitress who accidentally rescues the son of a werewolf and then has to go on the run with him because the father's hunting his boy. And it's fun, but again, as someone who lives in Los Angeles, it gets LA right, it gets the industry right, it's a lot of fun. So I like to be scared, but I also enjoy things that are impressed with how clever they are. So long as I'm as impressed with you as you are impressed with you, I'm going to enjoy your work. If you're more impressed with yourself than I'm impressed with you, I'm not going to like you very much. And I fear I'm probably the same way, so...
I feel that. I feel that. That's great. So there's some really good recommendations. I'm going to look into some of those, the play you're reading right now, talking about that. So that sounds really cool.
Excellent.
So Kevin, again, thank you so much for joining us. And remember, listeners, seek joy, even in horror.
This has been an episode of Horror Joy, produced in conjunction with Axis Mundi Media. Thanks for joining us. We want to hear from you. You can find us at Horror Joy Pod on Instagram or at Horror Joy Pod on YouTube. You can also email us at horrorjoypod@gmail.com, all one word. And you can, of course, find us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a like, subscribe, leave a review. Until next time, remember, seek joy, even in horror.
Hey everyone, it's your two favorite horror podcasters, professors, and nerds.
We're so excited to tell you about a new series from Horror Joy called Meet Your Maker.
This is a series dedicated to horror creators, their words, and their worlds.
We'll be sitting down for 30-minute interviews with some of horror's best-known authors and some of the best authors you don't know, like Clay McLeod Chapman,
Victoria Dalpy,
Kat Silva,
John Langan,
Sadie Hartman, Mother Horror,
Emily Hughes,
Thomas Ha,
Matthew Trefon,
Jake Try,
and so many more. Whenever we do it, we can both try to do so many more at the same time.
And so many more.
No.
I don't think that's working.
Our goal is always to find joy in horror, and this gives us the opportunity to introduce you to new authors and creators and to discuss new books, stories, and movies with your old favorites.
This also means that we'll be dropping episodes every week.
So, get ready, Yins, for more horror, more joy, more horror.
Horror joy!